Any last thoughts before you sign off and go on your crazy adventure?
I'm just excited to go and have a great time with my dad and all his friends.
Okay, I'm sure there's going to be many antics to talk about next week. But with that, we're going to sign off and we're going to pass you over to the news.
Thank you.
Good evening. It is 5 p.m. on Thursday, May 7th, and you're tuned in to CFRC 11.9 FM, broadcasting from Lower Carruthers Hall on Queen's Campus in Kingston, Ontario. I'm CFRC's broadcast journalist, Christina Laurie, and this is Kingston Currents, your weekly roundup of the latest Limestone local news. CFRC's news programming is brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, and for our podcast, Smith Engineering at Queen's University. Our feature story coming up in today's episode, an update on the future of Kingston's addiction and mental health services. With the closure of the city's consumption and treatment services site on the horizon due to loss of provincial support, and recent news of the city being approved for a provincial heart hub, council discussed and ultimately approved a multi-part response to support the community through this daunting transition to the abstinence-only recovery model. In other news, we'll be running through some more updates directly from City Hall, your weather and traffic report for this upcoming weekend, and a few events to keep on your radar from CFRC's events and concerts calendars. Without further delay, let's dive in. At their last meeting, council once again tackled the uncertain future of Kingston's addiction services. It was announced in March that Consumption and Treatment Services, CTS, which has operated alongside the Integrated Care Hub since 2018, would close effective September 30th, 2026. The CTS serves hundreds of vulnerable residents annually, preventing overdose deaths and averting emergency room visits. This closure is due to the provincial decision to cut funding to CTS sites across Ontario, effective June 13th. After much uncertainty about what would come next, the province announced on April 10th that a new Homelessness and Addiction Recovery Treatment Hub, or Heart Hub, will be established in Kingston. Provincial Heart Hubs will provide services related to addiction recovery, primary care, and supportive housing. However, unlike the CTS model, Heart Hubs require abstinence as a condition of access and will not provide services like drug checking, needle exchange, and safe consumption. Counselors and local experts alike have acknowledged there will be significant gaps upon the closure of CTS.
Without a replacement, you aren't cleaning up a neighborhood, you're moving the medical emergencies out of the controlled clinic and into the public parks, our alleyways, and our business doorways. You are turning the entire city into an unmonitored injection site. These deaths won't be hidden, they will be on our sidewalks. If you remove CTS and leave only the AMHS in that building, you are pushing the remaining staff to the brink. They lose almost half their specialized team while the crisis remains at 100%.
Supervised consumption services are part of a continuum of care. They cannot exist on their own, but they also cannot be adequately replaced by other services, including heart hubs. Addiction is a complex medical condition that affects outwardly visible behavior, so it's easy for people to form opinions about how someone should act or what treatment should work, but this is a medical issue, and we should not rely solely on opinion. We should rely on systematic observation and data. And even if Kingston had a heart hub, that would not change the fact that our community members still need supervised consumption services. It'd be like trying to run a trauma system and saying, we'll fund some bandages, maybe a tourniquet, and access to a surgeon, but we will not fund the ambulance to get people to the hospital. Certainly some injured people would still make it to the hospital, but many people would be left behind without the care they need. For some people, taking CTS away in the name of saving money will cost them their lives. If we truly value these lives, then money spent on CTS is money well spent.
This is exactly what will happen with the closure of the CTS. It will rob people of the opportunity to change and to become better themselves because they're not on our timeline.
In a lengthy meeting in March, council began discussing what the CTS closure means and how the city will navigate it. At their meeting on Tuesday, May 5th, now with the knowledge of a confirmed heart hub from the province, council continued the conversation. A motion from the Arts, Recreation, and Community Policies Committee came before council, laying out a multi-part response to the looming closure of Kingston's CTS site. Two pieces focus on understanding the impact. Council asks the city's chief administrative officer to report back on what the provincial decision will mean for the integrated care hub, everything from the building lease to programming. Staff are also being directed to work with Kingston Community Health Centers to collect detailed data on harm reduction services to paint a clearer picture of what's being lost. There's also a communications component aimed at making sure residents know where to turn. The city will work with local partners to share information about available supports once the CTS site closes. The most notable parts of the motion are two more action-focused items. First, Council is directing the city solicitor, alongside the mayor and chief administrative officer, to formally assess whether the situation warrants a municipal declaration of emergency. That assessment is expected back in the third quarter of 2026. Second, Council is committing $350,000 in new funding to support community-driven solutions. The money will go toward pilot projects proposed by local organizations, with a focus on new harm reduction initiatives that can potentially operate at a lower cost. Councillor Brandon Tozzo added one more item to the list with an amendment: that council formally opposed the provincial government's decision to close CTS.
I think that there's a substantial amount of work on the financial side has been done, but I think it's important that we send a clear message to the community where we as a political body stand on this. This is, closing of this will cause harm. It will affect a vulnerable community. And I want us to just make it a position that we fully oppose the closure of the CTS in the city of Kingston.
Councillors Gary Osteroff and Jimmy Hassan were opposed to the amendment. Osteroff was supportive of the new Heart Hub model as a replacement, and Hassan pointed to the provincial responsibility for healthcare matters.
I can't support this. I believe that the heart and with addiction recovery, I believe that it's the better way to go. So I can't support this.
I think it's not a good strategy to just oppose their decision. That was their decision. That's their department. That's their responsibility. So we have to live with it, but we'll continue to support whatever, however we can do. I will not support this amendment.
Mayor Brian Patterson, who seconded the amendment, spoke to the importance of CTS's place in the addiction care ecosystem in addition to a heart hub.
I think it was Councillor Ridge, who is not here tonight, who I think put it very eloquently when we first debated this, said what we really need is a CTS and a heart hub. This is not about suggesting that we're not in favor of the Heart Hub. The Heart Hub is great. It's a huge new investment into the community that will offer hope and recovery for those that are struggling with addiction. I'm a huge supporter of it, and I could hardly wait to see it up and running. What I'm suggesting, and I think that what has been discussed, is that ideally you would have both so that you can have a place where you can meet people where they're at. Obviously, not everybody is ready to immediately move into recovery, so allow them to be able to access harm reduction services and then be able to transition into the Heart Hub. I think you could see both of those working together. So this is really, in my view, I was happy to second this because I think it just shows on principle that if it was up to us, we would want both. It's not in any way poking at the province, where I think we've been very vocal that we've been helpful or very grateful for the Heart Hub, but I think it still is very clear that ideally you would have both. So for that reason, I'm happy to second this amendment.
The amendment passed with a vote of 8-2. Councillors Osteroff and Hassan opposed. When discussion returned to the full motion, Councillor Jeff McLaren spoke in support, especially noting the importance of the $350,000 in funding for new projects and the opportunity for change.
This came as a result of ideas that were coming from the public that could help support the city's harm reduction efforts at a lower cost. And since we are looking for ways to save money, it seems that this is an opportunity to see if that could happen. That's the whole point of this pilot project. Take ideas from people on the front lines that want to start new enterprises, social enterprises that actually benefit people in a new and different way. I think this is a great way forward, and I hope that it succeeds, because what we've been doing up until now seems to be the situation seems to be getting worse, regardless of what we continue to throw the money we throw at it. So it's time to find some new ideas, and hence the word new community groups and new proposals.
Councillor Connie Glenn also spoke in support of the motion. with hope for the future of services in Kingston, but still bracing for the impact of the CTS site closure.
I'm very heartened to see this motion coming forward, and I hope that it's going to pass. I think I feel a positive wind here. I do believe that pilot projects may lead to some gold nuggets. We have deep-seated challenges here, and removal of support for the CTS is eventually going to hit this community really hard. So I think one of the things that needs to be reiterated here is that removal of these sites in other municipalities has led to an increase in overdoses. It's led to increased emergency room visits. Hamilton's one of the places that's been mentioned a few times that's seen this sort of thing happen. So I'm glad that we're going to do what we can to bridge the gap and hopefully preserve some services and see where we go from there. But in the short term, I think this is the right step forward for us. And then we'll have to have more conversations about how we get those other gaps filled and how we get the province to fill them for us, because we can't continue this way as we've seen with our budgetary pressures.
In the end, the motion carried with a vote of 9-1. Councillor Gary Osteroff opposed. Addiction and Mental Health Services KFLNA will be the lead agency for the new Heart Hub services. For now, the city clarified in a release that Kingston Community Health Center's Street Health Center will continue to provide primary care, addiction treatment, and harm reduction services. Low barrier services like the Access and Support Center, Rest Zone, and other integrated care hub programming will continue through and after the transition to a Heart Hub.
Hopefully things will not deteriorate any further with the interventions that we're putting in place.
Before we get into more local news, let's take a look at your weather and traffic report for the rest of the week. Starting with traffic, Johnson Street from University Avenue to Aberdeen Street, expect delays for a contractor to complete storm sewer improvements until July 30th. King Street East from Plast Arms to Barrack Street will be closed May 8th and 9th from 8 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. for the Science Rendezvous at Slush Puppy Place. On Bath Road between Sir John A. MacDonald Boulevard and Portsmouth Avenue, expect delays as crews continue installing intersection pedestrian signals. Over on King Street West, from Country Club Drive to Front Road, expect delays as Utilities Kingston work has reduced traffic to one lane in each direction. Watch for lane shifts, reduced speeds, and shared lane signage. At the intersection of Montreal Street and John Counter Boulevard, construction is ongoing, with delays expected through the rest of this month. To keep in mind for tomorrow, Cranbrook Street from Days Road to Lakeview Avenue will be closed from 8:40 to 9:20 and 3:20 to 3:50 as part of the School Streets program, restricting access during school drop-off and pickup times. These closures will not impact the weekend. Wright Crescent remains closed between Palace Road and Kingsland Crescent for roadway repairs and safety improvements. Construction continues on Princess Street from Frontenac to Division as part of a major reconstruction project. And finally, long-term closures remain in place on Aberdeen between Johnson and William and Barrie at Queen. Getting into your weather report, tonight you can expect mainly cloudy skies with a 30% chance of showers this evening and after midnight. Wind is coming from the southwest at 20 kilometers per hour, but becoming light later this evening. We have a low of +1 with patchy frost. Looking ahead, tomorrow, May 8th, we are starting the day with a mix of sun and cloud. Winds will be coming from the southwest at 20 kilometers per hour, and there is a 30% chance of showers late in the afternoon. We have a high of 12 degrees, and while the sun is out, the UV index will be at 6 or high. Clouds roll in later in the evening, and temperatures drop to a low of 6. On Saturday, May 9th, once again starting the day with a mix of sun and cloud, and we have a 40% chance of showers. Temperatures will reach a high of 14. We'll have a cloudy Saturday night with a 60% chance of showers and a low of 7. Finally, finishing off the weekend on Sunday, May 10th, more cloudy skies with a 40% chance of showers and a high of 14. The day finishes off with cloudy skies and a low of 6. This has been your quick traffic and weather report. Now back to more local news. We'll be right back. Kingston is gearing up for another packed season of community events, festivals, and civic celebrations. The City of Kingston has released its lineup of special events for 2026, highlighting everything from major holiday celebrations to cultural festivals and community partnerships happening across the city this year. According to the city, many of the civic ceremonies and events will once again take place at Confederation Park and Springer Market Square, with familiar staples like Victoria Day on May 18th, Canada Day festivities on July 1st, and New Year's Eve celebrations returning at the end of December. The city is also partnering with local organizations for a number of cultural and commemorative events throughout the year, including National Indigenous Peoples Day on June 21st and National Day for Truth and Reconciliation on September 30th, in collaboration with Kingston Native Center and Languages Nest and the city's Indigenous Initiatives Office. To name a few major events on the summer calendar, the Kingston Sheepdog Trials are set to return to Grass Creek Park from August 7th to 9th, while a special Rockin' in the Square concert celebrating the legacy of the Tragically Hip and the 10th anniversary of the band's final concert in Kingston will take place August 20th in Springer Market Square. The city also says another large-scale event tied to the anniversary of the Hip's final Kingston show is in the works for August 22nd, though details have yet to be announced. Kingston will additionally host a stop on the Canada Celebrates FIFA World Cup tour on June 27th, ahead of next year's international tournament buzz. Alongside the event announcements, the city is also putting out calls for volunteers, vendors, and sponsors. The release from the city says volunteers are needed to help with event setup, information booths, crowd flow, and activity areas throughout the year. And local food vendors, artisans, and businesses are being encouraged to get involved as well. Applications for volunteers and vendors are open through May 15th through the city's special events office. For more information on these events and these opportunities, be sure to head to the City of Kingston's website at cityofkingston.ca. In another release from the city, the first major event on that calendar is coming up fast. The city is inviting residents to kick off the unofficial start of summer over the Victoria Day long weekend, with free programming planned for Monday, May 18th at Confederation Park. According to the city, the long weekend will also mark the seasonal reopening of a number of park amenities after the winter months, including public washrooms, picnic areas, and most splash pads, as Kingstonians begin returning to outdoors for the warmer season. The evening celebrations in Confederation Park will feature live music, a drone show, and fireworks. From 7 until 9:30 p.m., the Kingston Music Office will present Ahead by a Century, a youth open mic showcase from the Visitor Information Center patio. The showcase will feature young local performers sharing original songs and covers as part of what the city is calling a Forever Hip Summer, referencing upcoming celebrations connected to the Tragically Hip later this season. There's also a sweet bonus for attendees, free slush drinks courtesy of Slush Puppy, while supplies last. Then at 9:30 p.m., visitors can look skyward for a drone show presented by Slush Puppy before the night wraps up with fireworks display starting around 9:35. The city says admission is free and the event is open to all ages. The city of Kingston is getting a snapshot of how people are moving through the community, and the number suggests some major shifts since before the pandemic. The city has released results from its 2024 Kingston Moves Household Travel Survey, a large-scale transportation study examining how residents get around on a typical weekday, whether that's by car, transit, walking, cycling, or working from home. More than 3,500 households participated in the anonymous survey, conducted by independent research firm R.A. Malatest and Associates. With residents reporting travel activity for everyone in the household over the age of 5 during a 24-hour weekday period. According to the city, Kingston residents still make more than 400,000 trips every weekday, but households are now making fewer trips overall compared to 2019. One of the biggest trends highlighted in the report is the rise in walking. Walking now accounts for 23% of all weekday trips in Kingston, up from 18% 5 years ago. When combined with cycling and transit use, active and sustainable transportation now represents roughly one-third of all weekday trips across the city. The survey also points to the lasting impact of remote work habits. The percentage of residents working entirely from home has climbed from 8% in 2019 to 13% in 2024, while nearly one in four full-time workers reported working from home at least one day a week. City staff say the findings will help shape several major transportation initiatives currently underway, including Kingston's Integrated Mobility Plan, Transit Service Review, and Micromobility Regulation Strategy. Transportation Policy and Programs Manager Matt Cusin says travel behavior varies significantly depending on where people live in Kingston, making this kind of data important for future planning decisions. Residents interested in digging deeper into the numbers can now view the full report on the city's website. A final update from City Hall this evening. The city is once again looking to support projects outside the urban core through the return of the Rural Community Program Fund. After launching as a pilot program last year, the initiative is expanding for 2026, with the city now offering funding for up to 6 rural projects, one more than last year, with successful applicants eligible to receive as much as $5,000 each. According to the city, the fund is aimed at helping rural community groups, volunteer organizations, event organizers, and local partnerships bring new ideas and events to life, while building community connections and attracting visitors to Kingston's rural areas. Eligible projects could include everything from concerts and festivals to nature walks, cycling initiatives, public art, beautification projects, and tourism experiences. Craig Desjardins, director of the city's Office of Strategy, Innovation and Partnerships, says last year's pilot highlighted just how many opportunities exist across rural Kingston for community gathering, recreation, and cultural programming. Applications are open until June 8th and will be reviewed by city staff alongside the Rural Economic Community Working Group. The city says projects will be evaluated based on community impact, collaboration opportunities, tourism potential, and financial feasibility. More information about eligibility and applications is available through the city's Get Involved Kingston platform. Before we wrap up this evening, I'm going to run through your weekend forecast, a roundup of just some of the events Kingston has to offer to finish off your week. Right after tonight's show, you can head to the Tet Center for a calm start to the evening. Paint without overthinking at 6. A relaxed painting session focused more on creativity than getting everything perfect. At 7, the Sydenham High School drama students present The Day the Internet Died. And at the same time, trivia takes over at both Riverhead and Something in the Water Brewing. For comedy fans, the Comic Strippers hit the Kingston Grand Theatre at 7:30 p.m. with an improv comedy show built around a parody male dancing troupe. Daft Brewing also hosts a stand-up comedy night starting at 8. Later in the evening, karaoke starts at Jersey's at 8:30 and The Buckle at 9, while La Vida hosts its weekly urban music social at 9:30. No shortage of events to start the weekend a bit early. Friday begins with Beat Council Beatmaking and Production with Will Hound at the Spire at noon, focusing on music production and beatmaking techniques. Also starting at noon is the perennial plant sale at Cook's Portsmouth United Church, running through the afternoon with a wide selection of spring plants and garden additions. In the evening, Little Cataraqui Creek Conservation Area hosts a frog night hike at 6:30. A guided outdoor walk exploring local wildlife and wetland habitats after dark. At 7, The Day the Internet Died returns to Sydenham High School, while Something in the Water hosts a salsa workshop for anyone interested in trying out Latin dance styles. Trivia also gets underway at Wild Wings Kingston at 7. To wrap up the night, karaoke starts at both Daft Brewing and The Buckle at 9. Getting into Saturday, May 9th, I think the busiest day this weekend, the Kingston Public Market runs from 8:30 to 5 in Springer Market Square with local vendors, produce, baked goods, and artisan products throughout the day. Science Rendezvous Kingston takes over Slush Puppy Place from 10 to 3 with hands-on science activities, demonstrations, and interactive exhibits for all ages. Also running during the day is the Spring Vendor Show at the Tet Center from 10 to 4, featuring local artists, makers, and small businesses. At 2 p.m., the Kingston Frontenac Library Central Branch hosts a public lecture with Gordon Duick, titled Haircuts and Cakewalks, The Forgotten Black Minstrels of Kingston's Musical Past, exploring a lesser-known chapter of Kingston's music and cultural history. Saturday night features comedy across the city, including Gary D's funny You Should Say That tour at the Kingston Grand Theatre at 7, followed by Yuck Yuck's stand-up comedy at Daft Brewing at 8:30. Finishing off the weekend on Sunday, May 10th, we start with the Memorial Center Farmers Market from 9 to 1, always a reliable spot to find your favorite local vendors. From 10 to 4, Sandy Pines Wildlife Center hosts a wildlife baby shower and open house, featuring educational programming and opportunities to learn more about wildlife rehabilitation. The Great Lakes Museum also hosts Sunday Fun Day from 10 to 1, with family-friendly activities along the waterfront. For Mother's Day, the Tet Center hosts a Mother's Day tea at 11:30, while the Italo-Canadian Club holds a Mother's Day luncheon beginning at noon. Sunday night wraps up with karaoke at both the Merchant and the Toucan starting at 9. A little peek into next week if you want to hit the ground running on Monday, May 11th. Karaoke returns to Time Out Bar at 6, followed by Trivia at One Eye Jack's at 7, the Brass Pub at 7:45, and Something in the Water Brewing at 8. That wraps up your weekend forecast. Once again, that was just a few of the events coming up this weekend in the region. Be sure to head to cfrc.ca for our full events listings. If you have an event you'd like to add to our online or on-air calendar, reach out today via cfrc.ca or at CFRC Music on Instagram using the link tree in our bio. That is all things current in Kingston for this week. Thank you for listening to CFRC's local news programming brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, and for our podcast, Smith Engineering at Queen's University. To revisit episodes and listen on the go, head to our podcast network at podcast.cfrc.ca. Be sure to stay tuned for more CFRC programming coming up next.
Music doesn't need a visa. 有些声音不用翻译也能听懂。No genre limits. Kokumonai. I'm your host, Hai Tong Ni. Tune in Thursday morning in 10 a.m. on CFRC. This is From CN to CA.
Coming up now on this week's Release Radar, in partnership with the Kingston Music Office, we're pleased to present a new single by Sons of Rick called Fusion Frenzy, a high-energy garage rock track inspired by the classic original Xbox party game that brought the band closer together through late-night couch co-op chaos. The song delivers punchy riffs and catchy lyrics that stay lingering in your head as an earworm. A longtime fan favorite at live shows, Fusion Frenzy captures the band's edge while turning a shared inside joke into an anthem. Are you a local musician who would like to be highlighted next time on our airwaves and social media? Just complete the Release Radar submission form on the Kingston Music Office website or via visit kingston.music on Instagram. In the meantime, stream Fusion Frenzy by Sons of Rick on your favorite platforms and enjoy it here right now with us on CFRC 101.9 FM.
As we go down to Hey, this is Laura Jane Grace from Against Me, and you're listening to CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston.
When it comes to Kingston real estate, local experience matters. Kim Purcell is an award-winning realtor born and raised in Kingston with over a decade of experience and 100 five-star reviews. If you want honest advice and results you can trust, choose Kim. Visit kimpurcell.ca today for more information.
Today on Wings, Janelle Orsi, author of the book Practicing Law in the Sharing Economy.
We have so many laws that are designed to protect people from one another, and sharing is people helping each other out. And there are actually laws that prevent people from helping each other out. There's a lot to learn and think about, and we need tons of lawyers to help people.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Janelle Orsi is a co-founder of the Sustainable Economies Law Center in the San Francisco Bay Area. She was profiled by the American Bar Association in 2010 as an attorney remaking the legal profession through the power of innovation. She was a 2014 Ashoka Fellow. Ashoka Fellows are, quote, social entrepreneurs who have innovative solutions to social problems and a potential to change patterns across society. Ashoka Fellows work around the globe in every area of human need, unquote. I'm Kelly Ramirez Watson. I began my interview by asking Janelle how she discovered sharing law.
Sharing law, I guess it was a phrase I put together in my head when I was a third year in law school. And at the time, I was living in Berkeley in what we called casual co-housing. So it was four households that lived adjacent to one another and that shared a lot of things. We shared laundry. We shared a garden. We shared meals a couple days a week. We shared a vacuum cleaner. And just sharing kept coming up in my life as a way that made my life easier. It helped me save money. It was cutting down on my impact on the planet. And so I started to think about just all of the people who are struggling to meet their needs in the society and the way that sharing, if we just take it to greater levels, could really do a lot of good. So I thought I could become a lawyer who helps people share things because there are a lot of agreements that need to be made, a lot of regulations that need to be navigated. And I decided to focus my whole law practice on sharing. Then I was also watching things around me in the Bay Area. Like, I got to know People's Grocery, the nonprofit in West Oakland that was creating community gardens and was also working to create a worker-owned grocery store at the time. And these ideas just made so much sense to me, particularly in helping to meet the needs of young people in this society, to help meet their food and nutrition needs and the needs for jobs. So I was just seeing examples all around me and ways that sharing was benefiting a lot of people.
Any other ways you would describe sharing law?
Sharing law. It's a field of legal practice, and I sometimes refer to it as sharing economy law. Sometimes I call it community resilience law. Sometimes people call it sustainable economies law because my nonprofit is Sustainable Economies Law Center. But basically, it's a field of law practice through which lawyers and other legal professionals provide support to people in forming organizations and forming agreements to share things. So drafting agreements, drafting bylaws for cooperatives, helping people choose and structure collaborative entities, helping people understand how their sharing arrangements could bring up employment law, tax law, securities law, health and safety laws, and a lot of regulations come up, and I didn't even expect this when I became a sharing lawyer, but we have so many laws that are designed to protect people from one another, and sharing is people helping each other out, and there are actually laws that prevent people from helping each other out. So there's a lot to learn and think about.
Where do you think that regulations most harm attempts to share?
Regulations that have been designed to temper the harms of really large companies have also had the perverse effect of privileging those really large companies. So companies that have a lot of money, for example, to register securities offerings to raise money and capitalize their businesses are also the businesses that succeed because they have access to capital. But let's say someone is starting a new farm and they need to raise a little bit of money to get a tractor and to lease some farmland. Maybe they want to raise $50,000. They can't just advertise to their community that they want maybe 50 microloans of $1,000. You can't do that without a substantial amount of legal compliance. And so it means the small scale economic activities just can't even compete with the large ones because they can't comply with the same laws that were designed for the big ones.
There's some changes going on, not only here, but in Europe as well, about crowdfunding for small firms. You think that's going to take off in the U.S.?
I do. And part of the reason why I think it's going to take off is because the Sustainable Economies Law Center, our organization, just wrote a law that we are shopping around to legislators in California. We have at least two legislators who are interested. And I think we're going to call it the Local Economy Securities Act. But one thing it does is reduces barriers for farmers to raise money to purchase farmland. It also just reduces barriers to a wide variety of things that we think create more sustainable local economies, like solar energy projects, community-supported agriculture programs, worker-owned cooperatives. And so if this law is passed in California, it means that projects that are relatively low-risk investments but high impact for community resilience will be able to get the capital they need to get started.
What else does the Sustainable Economies Law Center do?
We have 10 different programs. We work on energy, housing, food, all realms of life. A major goal of ours is to think about the legal profession itself and what lawyers do and how they practice, and get lawyers all over the world trained to tailor their services to the creation of more sustainable local economies.
You wrote this book called Practicing Law in the Sharing Economy. Are you one of the leaders or the founders of this as a legal discipline?
One thing that I've done is I think I've brought together a lot of legal practice areas under one umbrella of sharing economy law or community resilience law, because there are definitely lawyers everywhere who have provided legal support to cooperatives. I shouldn't say there are many lawyers, but there are lawyers in every state because there have been cooperatives around, you know, since the 19th century. But there are also lawyers who have created co-housing communities, lawyers who have provided support to nonprofit community farms. But the lawyers who do this work hadn't actually identified themselves as part of a movement or part of a area of focus. And so I think that my work has really helped to bring that together under one umbrella. And then the book was published by the American Bar Association. And a lot of lawyers around the country and actually around the world have reached out and said that they found the book and it really spoke to them as something that they had sort of in the back of their mind been wanting to do, or it helped to communicate what they were trying to communicate about their priorities. And so it's helping to create a community of lawyers internationally.
You said in a video that I saw that 70% of Americans are not being adequately served by the legal profession. Could you elaborate on that?
Well, most people think of lawyers as being very expensive, and lawyers do charge anywhere from $200 to $500 an hour, even $600 an hour. A friend of mine told me that's what his law firm charges for his time. So lawyers have made themselves inaccessible to anybody but maybe the top 10 or 20% of society. There are nonprofit legal service organizations that are meeting some of the needs of some of the lowest income members of society. But even those organizations say that they have to turn away pretty much, I think, 4 out of 5 of the requests for legal services. So it leaves a huge gap in the middle between the wealthiest and the poorest members of society of people who have day-to-day legal needs, needing support for family law, for buying or renting their homes, for creating wills or trusts, for starting their own businesses. There are a lot of just aspects of life that require a little bit of legal expertise from time to time, and people just don't think about hiring a lawyer because they can't even imagine affording it. So lawyers have really elevated themselves to this place in society where they have made themselves inaccessible to the vast majority of people, And it has really benefited lawyers to do this for a long time because the wealthiest sector of society has had enough work to keep lawyers busy. And I think that bubble has now begun to burst. And there are a lot of unemployed lawyers who should be shifting the focus to serving more average members of society to do average legal work. Transactional lawyers, as opposed to litigators who go to court, transactional lawyers are the people who draft contracts and form organizations and just advise people on here are your steps to complying with the law.
Transactional lawyers might be needed for the sharing economy.
We need tons of transactional lawyers to help people do this because we have to create a whole new economy. I think we need to create a whole new economy. We need to replace all of the giant businesses that are destroying our planet. We need to replace them with community-managed, localized, sustainable businesses, and we need tons of lawyers to help people set those businesses up.
But I'm sure that there aren't yet courses in sharing law in a lot of places. So how does a lawyer get started with that?
Well, one thing that I like to make sure that the whole world knows is in 4 states, California included, you can become a lawyer without going to law school. So there are 4 staff members in my organization who are apprenticing either with me or another attorney to become lawyers. And so they're learning this work on the ground, basically learning it in practice. For people who have already become lawyers, I think the best thing to do is to just start taking clients and looking at what's already out there and how lawyers have assisted in the development of cooperatives and other new economy enterprises and try to replicate those models. But as far as what law schools are doing, there's a little bit of change happening here and there. There are transactional community economic development law clinics at maybe 20 or 30 different law schools that are starting to think more progressively, thinking more along the lines of supporting community scale economic projects. And so that's a step in the right direction. But overall, legal education hasn't changed quickly enough to keep up with the needs of our society. New York has the apprentice program, although you do need 1 year of law school. 3 other states, Washington, Virginia, and Vermont, those 3 states, you don't need to go to law school at all. And then Maine, you have to go to law school for 2 years and you can apprentice for the rest. And my organization has a blog called likelincoln.org, and we started a Facebook group called Apprenticing to Become a Lawyer. So now we're being contacted by people in other states who said, oh, I wish I could do this in my state. How could I lobby legislators or the Supreme Court to change this and make this a viable pathway to becoming a lawyer? Because the other problem in the legal profession right now is lawyers are graduating law school with $200,000 of debt and they can't find jobs, and it's just not an economically smart decision to go to law school anymore. But we still need lawyers. Yeah. So.
Are there enough sharing lawyers in the formal sense that they recognize this as a legal discipline to have your own professional organization like the trial lawyers? You have your own convention?
I think there's just about to be enough lawyers doing this work. Our organization is creating a web platform for community building and resource sharing, but we're hoping we'll create an organization of sorts. Also, our organization has a fellowship program, and we've helped mentor 11 attorneys as they've been starting their law practices in this realm. And a bunch of them got together and have formed the Sustainable Economies Lawyer Association, something like that. And so I think this is going to start emerging. I think lawyers are going to realize they need to come together and learn from one another.
On Wings, you're hearing Janelle Orsi, author of Practicing Law in the Sharing Economy and co-founder of the Sustainable Communities Law Center. Interview by Kelly Ramirez Watson was conducted for Wings in 2014.
Is the U.S. a leader in sharing law, or are other countries more ahead of us in that way, and which ones?
I took a speaking tour through 3 cities in Australia last year and made a lot of connections, and I think that helped to spark the creation of an organization there. I don't see really a unified movement elsewhere, such as Europe or South America, but I hear from attorneys there that they are interested in these things. And of course, Europe and South America are places where I see a lot of examples of great things happening, especially in the realm of worker-owned cooperatives. And so there must be lawyers who have come together and created best practices around that.
Specifically, what areas of life could we be sharing more but for current law?
We could be sharing more in the realm of food. were it not for a lot of health and safety and agricultural laws that prevent us from doing so. A really disturbing example right now is that there are seed sharing libraries throughout the U.S. There's at least 300 of them. There are places where people can go and get free seed to grow vegetables and other plants. And then they're encouraged to harvest seeds later on and then donate seeds back to the library. And at least three or maybe four states now, the departments of agriculture have said, no, you can't do this. This violates seed labeling laws, laws that say you have to test the seeds that you're providing to people and label them with the testing information. So seed libraries can't comply with this. In the realm of food, when people come together and create formal arrangements to share food, or they go out into the community and donate food, like Food Not Bombs goes into the community and gives food out to people, they're often cracked down upon due to health and safety laws. And they're just so restrictive that it's going to basically force a lot of people to go hungry if we don't create exemptions for community scale food sharing. And it's also very hard if you grow food in your backyard to find out how to comply with the laws in order to sell that food. I guess another area of law that is just going to prevent the localization of our economic system is zoning laws, because zoning laws have divided up our cities and divided up the function of our lives to be separate from each other. So we live in a residential zone and we might work in an industrial zone. We go shopping in a commercial zone. Our food comes from an agricultural zone, and these could all be very separate from each other. But if you want to relocalize economies, you want to create the ability to grow food in our neighborhoods and do small-scale, cottage-scale manufacturing and to trade and exchange with neighbors. And that brings residential, industrial, agricultural all back into our neighborhoods, which violates zoning laws. And so we really have to rethink that whole framework for urban design.
How does the gender breakdown among attorneys work out? Do women find themselves more interested in sharing law than men? Do you feel that it's fairly equal? What have you seen in your experience?
Sometimes I wonder if our sample size is too small, but it's been a lot of women attracted to volunteer in our organization, and our fellows are mostly women. But it's definitely the case that men have been emerging and been involved and been very interested in doing this work. Of course, the majority of lawyers in our society are men, though increasingly law schools are seeing more women. And in some cases, I think the majority of many law school classes are now women. So I'm hoping that'll bring greater balance. But yeah, I haven't. Other than that, I don't know if I've noticed any trends so far.
So what do you think is the impact of the sharing economy on the environment?
I think it's inevitably going to reduce consumption. If by sharing economy you mean people are actually sharing tangible goods, providing for one another locally, I think probably one of the greatest impact things that we could do is share housing, because the way that we have built the majority of housing infrastructure in this country, at least, is around single-family units. Every household needs to have their own kitchen and need to have their own living areas. And I think co-housing has helped to create new models that give people less personal space, but a much, much more shared space, but overall takes up less land mass and encourages people to provide for one another more and share tangible goods that each household might otherwise have to buy, like equipment, vacuum cleaners, and so on. So I think shared housing or just much more community-oriented living will really reduce our consumption a good deal. Sharing transportation is another realm. You know, the phrase sharing economy has been picked up and applied to a lot of things that don't even necessarily reduce our consumption. They might even do the opposite. So Uber and Lyft are companies that enable people to get rides with strangers who are, in effect, operating taxis in their private vehicles. And so in some ways, this could be leading people to take more car trips rather than fewer, because it's possible that they're ordering a Lyft vehicle or an Uber vehicle when they'd otherwise take a shuttle or a bus or a train or bicycle. But the power that could come from such technology and such practices is if people who are driving their car someplace are able to use an app to find other people who need to go to and from the same place. And in that way, we fill the empty seats in our cars, and cars are one of the biggest culprits in climate change. And so that'll make a huge difference when people really start to practice ride sharing, car sharing.
So we're going to have, with more sharing, less need for duplicative things. What's the impact of that, though, on the vaunted job creation?
I think it just means that people are going to be doing jobs and creating things that we actually need, such as solar panels and organic food and buildings built out of renewable materials. And there's a lot of labor that's going to be needed in order to create a more sustainable world. So I don't think we should worry that there's not going to be work for people to do. I think we should be worried that people are not getting out of jobs in these destructive industries fast enough. But everybody who works in coal industry or fracking and all of these things, of course, create jobs, but they're going to destroy the planet for all of our children and grandchildren. And gosh, there's a lot of work to do in renewable energy. So we shouldn't let the whole job issue hold us back from doing any of this. But yeah, it's definitely a sensitive issue because it does mean people's lives will be upset, at least during the transition.
Do you see the sharing economy and sharing law as a way we can transition to a moneyless society where economics is based on fulfilling needs rather than making money? You know, the derivatives market is 7 to 10 times the value of the world's real goods and services, and I think that's a problem.
Yeah, that's a problem. Yeah, I think sharing is going to basically enable us to feel a greater sense of confidence that our needs are going to be met. And I think it's not that we need money, it's that we need the assurance that our basic needs are going to be provided for. And there are many other ways to do that beyond simply working a job and earning money to buy everything we need. And so a lot of our needs can increasingly be met through the gift economy. And by the gift economy, I mean, you know, people borrowing and lending things from each other, sharing ownership of things. All of that will replace a lot of the things we do currently spend money on. And then there will also be ways to recognize people's contribution and help them, in a sense, bank their contributions in order to provide for themselves in the future. I think what a lot of people are worried about is we need to save money because we're going to grow old and at some point we won't be able to work and we're going to need to have savings to provide for ourselves. But I think society can figure this out. We can come up with ways to ensure that people will be provided for in the times of their lives when they can't make as much of a productive contribution. Through time banking, for example, you know, people can accumulate time dollars or time credits for the work they do or the favors they do for others, and that they can later on benefit from by receiving favors from others.
I'm a little concerned about that because exactly favors are gifts. And then this time banking turns it into an economic transaction. Whereas mm-hmm. I might want to go ahead and give you something just because you're my friend. It makes time a different currency, but it's still this exchange model.
It's true. There have been many opportunities for me to participate in a time bank or to get time credits locally for things that I've done, but I haven't felt the need to because, again, we all have a natural instinct to provide for one another, to provide gifts for one another. But I think one example where time banks succeed is in elder care and other caring professions because it can be very labor intensive, time consuming, and not always the most pleasant work, but eventually, all of us are going to need it for ourselves or for family members. And in Japan, their system, their time bank for elder care has been more successful than other time banks.
Have you run into the argument that this idea of sharing economy and sharing law and co-housing and things like that is a limit to people's freedom? That freedom is doing it yourself, by yourself, for yourself, and the sharing business is just a bunch of pinko communism.
There's something in sharing that intimidates people, especially people who feel that they need to have control over their personal space, over their time. But I think in many ways it's going to give us more freedom because right now so many people are just slaves to this demand that we earn money and slaves to our 9-to-5 jobs, and I think most people just aren't free to begin with.
Do you think that measurements other than GDP will help develop the sharing economy?
Yes. Measurements can serve multiple functions, and one of them, I guess, is to help us prioritize the use of our resources But I think in general, we need to recognize the value in different types of business models. So recognize what is a worker-owned business and what are the benefits that it's providing to the workers and to the local community. And if we're able to recognize that and measure it, then we as a society can provide benefits to such businesses to encourage their growth. Because right now, many worker cooperatives struggle to get off the ground. But if we were able to see the many benefits they provide, it would enable us to prioritize them. I think another measure is just to know the economic impact of local spending. And so if I spend a dollar in my local economy, it's much more likely to be respent in my local economy. It's kind of like a pinball machine. I like to use that metaphor, which is in a pinball machine, a ball goes in and it bounces around. And each time it bounces off of something, your points are going up. And that's like a dollar in the local economy. So if we could measure the value of spending a dollar at a locally owned, worker-owned business versus spending a dollar at a Walmart or a big box store and recognize that that dollar at that local business is going to be worth maybe even five times as much as the other dollar to our local economy. Having those types of measurements will help us prioritize the economic development funds that we use, the regulations we impose on businesses, and so much more. We can calibrate our legal system to prioritize what actually benefits us.
What's being done politically in the United States or elsewhere to promote more sharing?
There are a handful of cities where the city government has recognized sharing as a priority. Seoul in South Korea is one of them. San Francisco is one of them. San Francisco's mayor created a sharing economy working group. I can't name all the other cities, but I think cities in general are revisiting their policies and revisiting their funding priorities and thinking about sharing in its many forms. Some cities are thinking, how can we prioritize worker-owned businesses? Other cities are thinking about shared transportation. Different cities are looking at different pieces of the sharing economy, but all with the recognition that it's going to benefit us locally.
Anything else?
Well, I focus a lot of my energy on cooperatives and especially worker-owned cooperatives. And I think that is a piece of the sharing economy that a lot of people have not wrapped their minds around yet or don't really see. What is the value? What is the potential impact? But the two things people should really know about worker-owned cooperatives is that they're democratically governed, meaning workers control their work environment and their jobs. And they distribute their earnings to workers on the basis of the value of the work they do. So they're not people who are working to earn profits and limitless profits for others. There are people who are working basically to benefit themselves. And that's going to really change the flow of wealth in our society. We have such enormous wealth inequality right now. Worker cooperatives have enormous power to shift that. And I think we really need to grow cooperative literacy in society so that everybody graduating from high school understands what a worker cooperative is and can say what a worker cooperative is and would aspire to work in a worker cooperative, because if the opportunity is there, I think everybody should want to have control over their work and not let somebody else capitalize off of their labor. So worker cooperatives might be the moral to many stories in the sharing economy.
California attorney Janelle Orsi, co-founder of the Sustainable Economies Law Center in the San Francisco Bay Area. The center's website is www.theselc.org. That's theselc.org. For Wings, I'm Kelia Ramirez-Watson in Berkeley, California.
Since this interview was recorded, the California Local Economies Securities Act stalled in the state legislature, but the Sustainable Economies Law Center mapped out other strategies to help local projects secure investment. And they've gained an international following on social media. Their website is theselc.org. Wings thanks all our supporters, including your local community radio stations, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, whose events can be found on the website maternalgifteconomymovement.org. The Wings sound logo is from Libano's album A Circle Is Cast. I'm Wings series producer Frieda Worden. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.
And when I listen to a really good song, I start nodding my head like I'm saying yes to every beat.
Yes, 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 this rocks.
And then sometimes I switch it up like,
no! No! Don't stop a rockin'!
every Friday morning, 8 a.m. to 10 a.m. You can't possibly find it funny anymore. It's been years. Let it go.
This is Harry from Adult DVD. You're listening to CFRC 101.5.